All right, now, new recruits, welcome to your first day here at Radio Flange Goblet. Here our motto is that we guarantee the most entertaining radio that we can provide, which honestly is a little limited, as everyone who works here would rather be somewhere else that paid a livable wage and didn't force us to wear bloody itchy bright mauve tops. It's not a great motto, granted, it needs work, but Sandra in accounting, who came up with it, couldn't be much more bothered than that to perfect it. By now, you should all have the aforementioned itchy mauve top, regulation stupid haircut, and I can see that you've all perfected your slack-jawed, confused face, some of which I have to say, are really top grade, really quite perfect. People may wonder why we're forced to wear said itchy tops if this is radio and nobody can see us. Questions like that will be met with a sentence of 3 weeks hard time in the station's replica gulag, during which time you'll also only eat what you can find in the janitor's basement fridge or what you're able to pick out of your colleague's hair. Now, as laid down in the company bylaws, which were written in 1988 when old Flange Goblet first started this, well, I won't say great, but moderately average radio company, you'll all now have to wrestle the company mascot, which, if you don't know, is an enraged polar bear. Now, don't worry. Although originally it was a real live polar bear, mad old Mr. Goblet realized he was losing too many employees too soon, and so in 1995, a man in a polar bear costume was substituted. Our current polar bear man and grand high wizard of naughty late night programming is Alan, and so while it is certainly good news that it's not a real live polar bear, it is Alan, and he takes his job role very seriously, so some of you, I'm sorry to say, will still not make it. Those of you, though, who do make it will have one very simple but still quite dangerous and potentially life-threatening task, and that will be to listen to our flagship, well, more of a flag barge, really, our flag barge film review program, The After Movie Diner. During this terrifying ordeal, Klaus will prod you with sticks, perform some outrageously naked ritualistic dancing, and attempt to auction off his cousin Pippa, who likes strangling puffins, men who aren't afraid to strangle puffins, and designing art out of the carcasses of puffins and the scalps of men who are too afraid to strangle them.
Sir?
Yes, Biggleswade Jr. Elk Foreskin, what is it?
Well, what's the After Movie Diner?
Well, I'm glad you asked. Tungsten?
Yes, sir?
Roll the tape.
Okay, sir.
You're listening to the sweet sounds of the After Movie Diner with your host, John Cross.
Well, hello again. It's the After Movie Diner.
With noted influencer.
With noted influencer.
And Boylan's soda peddler.
Boylan's soda peddler. Boylan's soda enthusiast. I don't know who I influence.
Boylan's soda into sending you free sodas. So
well, yeah, there's that. I've influenced Boylan's into sending me more Boylan's.
Which, as far as some influencers go, they can't even make that happen. Do you know what I mean?
Right, so but other influencers get their own TV shows.
Look, I'm not saying it's not a sliding scale. I'm just right. Saying you're on it. You know what I mean?
I'm on the list. Way down the list. Yeah.
At some point, the New York Times will run a list of like top internet influencers, and the list will be long enough.
Oh no! No!
It'll be like you know,
because there's literally people
759,231.
There are people who
in
had
Brooklyn.
Right. There are people who have had millions and millions and millions of hits and have gone on to have either TV and or musical careers. There are people who have hundreds
Your
of thousands.
Your career is not over yet.
People who have had hundreds and thousands of hits who have gone on to like, oh, there goes our little
I will be back with the chicken.
We're in Blue Ribbon Chicken, by the way. There are people who've had hundreds of thousands of hits who have gone on to do, I don't know, a slightly bigger web series, or have appeared on Rachel Ray for 20 minutes expounding
Rachel Ray
what
for
makes
20 minutes.
A perfect hot dog or some horse shittery of the highest order. And that's a small fry.
Yeah, that's a lot of
right?
Fries.
That is enough for three people.
Look at my barbecue pulled chicken sandwich.
It's amazing. We're in Blue Ribbon Chicken, mainly because Jim is an ass. I feel like it's become fortuitous because we went and saw a movie at the Metrograph Theatre where they sold Boylan's by the bottle, and now I'm in a restaurant, well, you know, a upmarket fast food joint. Jim's going to have a problem
Jesus,
with
this. No, Jesus Christ, but I've got a barbecue pulled chicken sandwich, and it's unbelievable.
Oh, so he's happy. Thank fuck for that.
Look,
so anyway.
Look, the reason we're here, right, is that restaurants in New York carry grades.
Oh,
right?
Don't go into
A,
it.
B's or C's.
Nobody
no,
cares.
I'm just saying.
Nobody
A, B's
cares.
Or C's. Now, the way that, if you have a B or a C, no bugger's going to eat that. No one. So how they get around it is, they hang grade pending signs in their windows. And grade pending might as well mean, could be anything, mate. Do you know what I mean? Could be cockroaches.
That's not what I mean.
Cockroaches okay. are going to serve you your breakfast if you eat here. But it could.
No.
It could be like a
you
Pixar
can only
cockroach
that's
going to cook your dinner.
The only reason there's a grade pending is if it's on the line between an A and a B.
This is well, this is like, in the words of Lister, this is well nasty. I'm going to have to eat it before the bread dissolves.
Well, grab a napkin, please.
I'm going to need napkins for it.
So anyway, enough of Jim's twaddle.
Never. There will never be enough of my twaddle.
We went to the Metrograph.
For the loyal listeners of the After Movie Diner.
Oh, for fuck's
sake.
Who
for some reason keep coming back. I assume...
All 12 of them.
Because they find my twaddle not completely and totally objectionable.
So... We ended up in Blue Ribbon Chicken. And I'm at least
fries are bloody good too.
Happy that we did, because they also serve Boylan's. So this episode of the After Movie Diner is brought to you by Boylan's.
Boylan's. Naturally made cane sugar sodas in glass bottles. They taste bloody good. I can especially recommend the grape and the cream and the black cherry and the orange. Right, now back to the show.
Well, I'm an influencer, mate. I'm an influencer.
You're an influencer.
I go out.
You, it's what you do, mate.
It is. Worldwide.
A peddler pedals.
Yeah.
A bicyclist cycles.
You furiously backpedal quite a lot.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. And you, influence.
So we went to see a movie that until it was announced, I had never bleeding heard of.
No, me neither.
Called Scarecrow.
Well, I'm very surprised I hadn't heard of it.
The like, 70s.
I assumed I wouldn't have heard of it because it wasn't much good, or I don't know, it was like too super bleak for anybody to like talk about or watch. But it was Gene Hackman and Al Pacino.
Yeah.
In a movie from the 70s, like a kind of weird, funny, bluesy road trip. It was like kind of Candy Mountain-ish almost.
Yeah, I mean, I was going through the list of films and books and shit in my head that are like this, but it fits into, I mean, it's nothing like Vanishing Point in terms of like the cars and the speed and everything, but it's certainly got like man's existential walk across America, and man's existential travels across America.
Jesus, this sandwich is not easy.
You know, it's a little bit... There's certainly, like, With Nell and I elements in it. There's certainly Steinbeck elements in it. There are certainly, you know, Bacow...
Even though the guy in the question and answer session afterwards...
The director.
I so felt for the guy asking the question. Because he was trying to be nice, I think. Because it was that initial, oh, nobody's asking a question. So, yeah, he was being a bit of a smart-ass, but... It was the worst thing that could happen to you if you're asking a director you admire, oh, how influenced were you by Of Mice and Men? Because, you know, obviously you were pretty influenced. You went, no, not really. I mean, there's two guys in it. It's set in America. He was so dismissive of the idea.
Right.
I suspect because Steinbeck is very serious and dealing with very real, like, social issues at the time. And there's not a lot of humour in Steinbeck, to be honest. It's not a barrel of laughs of Mice and Men. Whereas what I like most about the movie is, because I thought,
hang on.
I didn't even let you finish.
So there's, you know, Kerouac, Bukowski, you've got movies like Candy Mountain, Vanishing Point, Into the Wild, With Nell and I. I'm trying to think, there was a few more that I thought of in the 70s that was sort of, but basically, oh, and one of the biggest things I thought was The Fisher King. Like, essentially, the second half of The Fisher King has lots of the same elements.
Yeah, it's quite similar.
You know what I mean? Like, The Fisher King. And it's funny, because he's like, oh, you know, it's the king and the court jester, Vilmos Sigmund, who is the cinematographer, said to the director, well, it's clearly a fairy tale. And so it definitely has those elements to it. It's a road
Something
movie,
else too,
it's like, a two-hander.
Wes Anderson clearly loves this movie because Royal Tenenbaum owes a lot to Max in this movie, I think. The portrayal of him.
Oh, no, see,
you know,
I would disagree because I think the Royal is a completely different character to...
No, he is. No, I'm not saying that, but I'm saying... I didn't realise until I'd seen Royal Tenenbaum.
Royal's a con man.
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying performance. Until I watched Royal Tenenbaum, I didn't realise that Hackman could be funny. Like, really funny.
Right.
And he's funny in this. Like, I see where Anderson got the idea of... I know Royal's not a con man, it's a bit more... But anyway, I just...
He is, he's a chancer. He's a car salesman who happens to have made it eked his way into the higher strata. That... Now he's trying to stay there.
Right, but that's what Max is. I mean, all Max wants is a car wash.
No. But, like, Max, as described in the movie, time and time again, Hackman's character in the movie, is this stubborn, carefully planning, put every bit of money he ever made into this bank in Pittsburgh, because the only thing is he's focused on is this idea of what he sees to be autonomy and the American dream, which is the idea of owning his own business. Because all he talks about throughout the movie is how he's been screwed over multiple times by various bosses that him or his girlfriend has had. And it's all about, fuck the man, I want to have my own car wash, I want to have my own thing. And he's this stubborn bull of a guy.
That's true, but every cop shot has a...
No, but he's nothing like Royal. I'm sorry, I have to like go again. He's nothing like Royal. Royal is a... Royal has some intelligence to him. Max has some intelligence to him, but it's very bog standard.
All I'm
it's
saying
very
is,
working.
I've generally only seen Hackman play a particular kind of character, and although he's slyly funny, Hackman, when he in whatever part he is, he's always slyly funny. But I felt he was playing a lot of the moments in this movie very deliberately for laughs, for the comedy inherent in whatever the scene was. And I hadn't seen him do that outside of Royal Tenenbaum. The idea of playing the scene for comedy that was there, but maybe wasn't on the page. I'm talking about performance, not character.
Okay.
That's what I'm saying.
I guess so. I saw him more in this that he's playing it straight, but because of the neuroses of the character.
I'm talking about Max.
Max. The neuroses of the character and the stubbornness of the character, humor was going to come from that. But I think Hackman is playing it straight. Now, I think Hackman's well aware that by playing it straight, there is humour there. But he's not playing it for shits and giggles.
No, but I'm saying, on the page, right? Take the scene where he's drunk on and he's talking about the sponges, right?
Right.
He's drunk, Like, he could play that, like you say, straight, and it could be a bit sad and a bit, like, I guess what I'm saying is that I thought this was going to be like a mopey 70s, you know, bleak movie where, you know, Pacino and Hackman ended up, you know, I don't know, dead and sellotaped to a rotting seagull or something, you know what I mean, like bleak,
right?
And instead it was funny and charming and really evocative, and even though it was like the grim, like the grim parts of America, like they didn't ever like go across a bridge to like a glorious city. It was all, they were always in the back streets and
right, they're in Denver, railway Detroit, yards, they're not beautiful cities. The landscape is beautiful, well, but right, cities are not.
But it was like, that's one of the first times ever in a movie where I felt like the transition of like where the countryside meets the city. You know, when they're walking down roads that are like scraggly and like it's, you can see the city in the background, you can tell that they've come from the, anyway,
yeah,
the point is, in that scene we talk about the sponges and he's drunk, that is funny, like, yes, he's being funny,
yes,
but he could have played it like straight and, oh, okay, melancholy and morose,
sure,
you know what I mean, but he made a decision to be, because it was there, his potential there to be funny, and he's not, they're not funny lines, it's just whatever it was, like, the funniest line was $300 sponges or whatever,
right, right, right,
and it was really, really brilliant, but all he said was $300 sponges,
right, agree. And the other thing is, you know, it's one step up from the Hank Chianski character in a Bukowski novel, whose sort of modus operandi tends to be, I'll work as long as I have to earn enough to drink. And when I once I have enough to drink, this job can go to hell until I run out of drink.
Yeah, they work careful, weren't they?
Whereas this is more, he has realized, because he's clearly, Max more than Lionel, Al Pacino's character, has clearly, like, ridden the rails and been through the hobo jungle and all the rest of it for a lot longer. So, you know, and he's done his, as he keeps telling, whenever pushed, he's done his work a job for a week to make a buck, you know, get annoyed by the foreman, fight the foreman, get fired, move on to the next thing. Like, he's done his time of doing that. And, you know, Max is a guy who walks into any building and immediately, just because of his nature, it's not that he's looking for trouble, but he knows that trouble will probably happen, and if it does, he won't back down from it.
I think that's what the thing with all the, like, that's what the clothes are, isn't it? And yeah, why the striptease scene is, like, so significant. He's, like, wandering around permanently, like, padded up cuckoo against the world, basically, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, not exactly spoiling for a rumble, but like you say, it's going to come find him and he's going to be ready.
But also, you know, it bulks him up a bit. It makes him look like the, you know, they definitely cast Pacino against him, because Pacino's not very tall anyway, but it, yeah, definitely makes Hackman look bigger, like a bear of a man. Like, you think of Hackman in Tenenbaum, surrounded by more average or taller actors,
yeah,
and he doesn't look like a big bear of a man. He doesn't look, no, small, but he doesn't look,
no,
but in this he looks like a big bruiser. Like, that might as well be, you know, John Goodman or Brian Dennehy. Like, he looks like a big dude, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And therefore casting Pacino, who's sort of 5'4" or whatever he is kind of also a bit genius, because not only does he look like the court jester to the king, even though they're both kind of hobos, but it also beefs up Hackman to be this constant bruiser who's always like rumbling for a fight. And it's basically because the two characters and where they collide is Al Pacino. The reason why the movie's called Scarecrow is Al Pacino's character is always trying to be on people's good side and always trying to make them laugh. And he believes that the Scarecrow in the field is an object of ridicule for the crows. It's not that they're scared of it, but that they're laughing at it. And so therefore the crows are like, well, isn't it nice? The farmer gave me a good laugh. I won't, like, eat all his crops. Rather than what we grow up to believe, which is crows are scared of the scarecrow, so they don't go anywhere near it because they think the farmer is in the field. So Al Pacino goes through life like wanting to make people happy and wanting to make people laugh and thinking like the best way to go through life is get on people's good side, because once you've made someone laugh, they're putty in your hands, basically.
Yeah, it's the same, but it's the same idea, isn't it? It's like, just like Hackman's got fighting, throwing the first punch. I mean, basically, Hackman's defense strategy is throw the first punch and, like, bundle up against the world, basically, don't get close to anybody.
Right, well, Hackman's thing is, I'm a cold-hearted bastard, I don't get close to anybody, I'm, you know, stubborn to a fucking fault. Like, it takes almost the whole film to, like, break Hackman of his lifelong stubbornness. Rocks up at his sister's house in Denver, where, conveniently, his sister has gone into a junk business with, to use the Google description of this movie, an earthy woman. In other words, a sort of a buxom strumpet, but seemingly someone who means good.
Yeah, but she's definitely, the word strumpet is well applied.
Yes, even though we find out later in the bar that, you know, Hackman is not the only man in this town's vicinity to have known her in the biblical sense. And Al Pacino, you know, is, we don't know that he's ever intimate with his sister, but they certainly form a bond, and he talks about his ex-wife and the child that he needs to go see in Detroit and various other things. He
opens his ex-wife.
His ex-girlfriend, whatever.
The woman he impregnated and ran away from.
Ran away from, right. So he opens up to her. So he sat around Denver going, well, hang on a second, why are we going all the way to fucking Pittsburgh to open a car wash, which is Gene Hackman's big plan, because cars will always be dirty and you can always make money at a car wash, thank you very much.
There'll always be cars and there'll always be dirt.
Right. He's like, why don't we just set up here? We've got, you know, I like your sister, you like this other bird, you know, it's comfortable here, there are cars here, but why don't we just... And he's like, nope, I've got my money in Pittsburgh, that's where we're going, blah, 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 blah. So, like, he's stubborn to a fault. And, you know, the sweet moment at the very beginning of the movie that kind of bonds the two of them together is when they meet on the road, Hackman's Zippo lighter runs out of fuel, and Al Pacino gives him his last, cardboard match from a matchbook.
I think that's the thing. Like, it's quite rare, I think, for me to know within 5 seconds, or maybe like 30 seconds, that I'm going to really like a movie.
Yeah.
But the opening shot was unbelievable.
Yeah.
All it is just like a hill with a tree and a fence, and Hackman walking down the hill. But it looks like a painting. It's indescribably beautiful.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, okay, well, that's amazing. It looks great. But what, you know, where are we going? What are we in for here? And then Hackman has to make his way through a barbed wire fence. And we were the only people in the cinema laughing, even though it was really funny.
Yeah.
He just gets caught in the barbed wire, and it's this a complete lack of dignity or planning or anything. It's just a guy who's decided to go through the barbed wire fence with no real plan.
Right.
And getting all caught up in fun. And it's just funny and really human, and we were laughing quite hard, and no one else in the cinema was laughing.
No.
And like, they laughed later, but I still think that was like one of the funniest moments in the film, other than the drunk thing, which also we were the only ones laughing anyway.
Yeah,
but
and also the genius of it, and I thought this would have spoiled it.
Well, I knew
the
I was
genius
love
is
it. I knew I was
once
love
he
it.
Gets through the barbed wire fence, puts his bag on his shoulder again, composes himself.
Yeah.
He immediately falls down a sandbag.
Yeah.
Which was so well played. And again, like,
I knew I was going
to
like it.
I mean, the one thing that has to be said about this film is, and where I would compare it to Royal Tenenbaums, when I watched Royal Tenenbaums, and to be fair, right, a lot of these guys who became very famous in the 80s and the early 90s, made their bones in 70s movies and did clearly by far their best work in that era. You know, because at a certain point, Al Pacino just plays Al Pacino. Like, every movie he's in, you're like, he's going to be charming a little bit, he's going to be shouty a little bit, and at one point his eyes are going to roll out of his head.
That's true, you're always watching Al Pacino, whereas in this one I really was watching a lot.
And Gene Hackman will always, you know, I always think of Gene Hackman weirdly when he's doing movies like that fucking courtroom drama with Dustin Hoffman or whatever, where he just plays
Runaway Jury,
where he just plays like a man in power who's a little bit conniving, a little bit grumpy,
yeah,
and can turn on the charm if he needs to, but essentially like you're not watching Hackman do much of a stretch, or like Crimson Tide or whatever. Like, it's just like these are the roles we grew up with him playing, and we were like, yeah, Hackman's great, but like, I mean, I suppose Superman is sort of the quintessential Hackman role that I remember growing up.
But he's sort of a charming bad guy,
right? But at no point was I like Hackman someone to watch until we saw Royal Tenenbaums, and then we were like, whoa! Like, literally in Royal Tenenbaums, you are nailed to the back of the theater, not by anyone else's performance, but by Gene Hackman. And without Gene Hackman in that movie, it is nowhere near the movie that it could be. I know that on set he was an absolute asshole. I know that he treated Wes Anderson like shit. I know that he had no regard for the rest of the cast. I know that he called them all cunts. Like, I know he was like awful. But
have you heard my theory as to why it's called? Did we talk about Royal Tenenbaums?
Maybe, I don't know.
Why it's called Royal Tenenbaums?
I don't know.
Have you ever thought about why it's called the Royal Tenenbaums?
Well, I know, isn't Tenenbaum like Christmas tree or something?
I know, I didn't know that. Maybe.
Yeah, I think it's like German or Jewish or something.
Sure, even if it is. But what I'm saying is, why is the movie called The Royal Tenenbaums?
I don't know.
Well, no, but have you never thought of that? Because I realised when I was watching it, and I realised, I just meant it as like, oh, well, it's, you know, the family's called the Tenenbaums, and they're sort of like a royal family, I guess. They're some kind of like,
well, his name's Royal
royalty,
as well.
And his name's Royal, so yeah, that'll do for my reason. But I realised it's called the Royal Tenenbaums because it's a story of two royal Tenenbaums. It's the royal Tenenbaum who leaves them all, you know, to suffer and go mad and fuck up their lives. And then there's the Royal Tenenbaum that comes back and saves them. But they're two very different people. They're two very different men with two very different effects in their lives. And that's why, but without both of them, there's no movie.
Right.
So that's why it's called the Royal Tenenbaum.
Right. Yeah, I like it. Very good. But anyway, so...
Thank you very much.
And before people are screaming at me and be like, but what about French Connection and what about... Look, I've seen all those movies and it's fine and it's great and everything. But I'm here to tell you right now that in my lifetime, I've seen two hands-down amazing, never-been-better Gene Hackman performances.
Agreed.
One is in The Royal Tenenbaums and one is in Scarecrow. Yep. His performance in Scarecrow is incredible.
Yeah, he is,
and the other thing to say about it is that
he does act Pacino off the screen, doesn't he? Which I was not expecting. He's still there, don't get me wrong.
But what's interesting
but
about Pacino
is
I've literally never seen Pacino like be this good. In
really?
It. And I tell you why, it's because in this film,
okay.
So all the goofy stuff Pacino does in this movie, right? Where he is doing goofy things.
Right.
That's actually really hard to do. And for you not to feel the embarrassment of the performer doing it.
Yeah, that's true.
And when Pacino does it, because it's not just that he's committing to doing the silly bit. He's committing to the character doing the silly bit.
Yeah,
like that
okay.
whole sequence around the fountain, which gets a little bit dramatic for me, but the bit where he's playing with the kids and then stares off in the distance and then goes back to playing with them and then like does that back and forth between them. Like, that is incredible. And to some people it might just be like, oh yeah, okay, so he does a funny pirate accent or whatever. But like, it's not...
Actually, there's a bit as
there's
well.
A way to
there's
do that where you're like, oh, he's just doing a pirate accent. And then there's a way to do it where you're like, fuck, this guy is in absolute despair at this moment.
But it's like in the,
and he's doing
in the striptease in the bar. When you're watching it, it's really funny. Gene Hackman's doing a striptease. He's taken on board Al Pacino's advice. He's going to be a scarecrow. He's not going to get into a fight. It's like it feels like a real pivotal moment in the movie. Like, the whole movie's been building up to this moment where Al Pacino finally wins Gene Hackman around to the idea of being a scarecrow. and you're totally with it. You're laughing, you're really enjoying it. And then it cuts to Pacino in the corner watching it happen, and there's this expression on his face that's like, it completely knocks you out of like the good mood you're in and how funny this all is. And it just, through Pacino's expression, you're like, this is, you know, it's, this is tragic.
You suddenly realise he's the only person in the bar not laughing.
Yeah, and he realises what's going on is Pacino's going, this is what I am. I've spent my whole life being this guy, being laughed at, and look where it got me. Look what it did. Look what it did to me. And what am I doing to this guy? It was all these things going on, and I'm not sure I could even necessarily articulate exactly what was going on.
Right.
With just the one expression that Pacino was wearing, and when it was cut to, while this, like, what seemed like this cathartic, funny, you know, revealing scene, and like with one expression, it's like something totally different.
Right.
But it totally upends the whole movie. And that's, it's that point that, because that's what the guy was saying when he was talking to the director, because he didn't really get to say it. But what he meant was, there's a point where it goes from being Hackman's film to being Pacino's film. Like, in terms of like where the focus of the movie is on the characters.
Right.
And it's at that point when Hackman's like dancing around, it's like his journey's over. And then Pacino's expression is like, and his is just, you know, now we're on Pacino. And everything from that point is, everything's about Pacino.
Yeah.
Not the performance or anything, but like the focus of the movie is about his character. And the fact that they leave it so unresolved, and yet somehow it's, like, it's not a bleak, like, your classic 70s bleak ending is, leave everything unresolved, so it's probably going to be, you know, terrible.
Right.
But in this case, they leave everything unresolved, and in not a great state, and yet, when the movie was over, I felt quite optimistic about their future.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Because all the way through the movie, although he's decided to trust Pacino, partner with Pacino, and blah, 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 blah.
Right.
The dream has always been his. Pacino has always been his sidekick.
Yeah.
The ending says Pacino has now become his purpose. It's gone from the car wash being his purpose to Pacino being his purpose.
Because he realises...
I don't want to spoil the ending, but I'm just saying...
Yeah, because like, you're right, because he realises that the car wash is meaningless. He can't do it on his own.
Right.
And there's only one person in the world that he trusts. There's only one person, basically, that he's taken, you know, metaphorically taken his clothes off.
Right. And the other thing is...
And the shoe thing works really, really well.
The shoe thing works because you only see
him... It wasn't cheesy at all.
You only see him put the shoe under his pillow once.
Yeah.
You then hear about it a second time when the woman in Denver says, they're all giggling around the table and saying he sleeps with his pillow on,
shoe under
his pillow.
And then you forget about it for another half an hour. When all this other dramatic stuff. And then right in the movie it happens.
Yeah.
And it's so funny, and yet also, but the whole movie, it's been a long time, I think, since I saw a movie where I wasn't completely sure of how the writer and director and actor like wanted me to feel this particular moment.
Right.
You know, it's like, we need you to feel this, and now you're going to feel that, and this is the next thing that you're going to be feeling, and at the end you're going to be left with this message.
Right.
You know? Whereas this was like, there was so much going on, and there was so much that was real and funny. And I think, the thing I like most about the movie is, it's essentially about two drifters trying to get from one place to another place,
right,
where there's like some kind of half-assed plan that everything's going to be okay, and that's the movie. But instead of making like a movie about like how bleak that is and the despair of it, they made a film in the same way that the two guys who were making that trip would treat it. Like, they would be like, they would be angry and they would be, you know, tired, but they would be reacting to things mostly with like humour and trying to see the funny side. And even if there's like, you know, huge bleak desperation every now and then, like, they don't want to, if they let that in, they're just going to curl up into a ball and they'll never move again, you know. So that the tone of the movie is not like all the bleakness of human reality. It's like the tone and the feel and the look of the movie seems to me like an exact, or an attempt to replicate like actually what those people's experiences would feel like.
But it's also an examination of like character absolutes. In other words, you know, Hackman's absolute is, no, I close myself off, I fight anyone who so much as even looks at me funny, and I'm going to go to Pittsburgh and I'm going to open up a car wash, everyone go fucking this up. Except
which
any,
I suppose you're
except
right.
any earthy women who fall along the way. And then Pacino's idea.
So just quickly, because it just occurred to me two things. One is, presumably one of the reasons it's a car wash is that he'll be dealing with machines and not people. Like people will drop off the cars and it's just machines. And then when Pacino asks him, what will I be doing at the car wash? He actually struggles to think of something.
Right.
Except like, oh, you'll entertain the people, you'll be with the people. And then he realises in that moment, again, I'm just thinking about what I'm talking to you now. He realises that there are going to be people in this business. People are going to bring their cars.
Right.
And he can't handle people. He can't deal with people. Without Pacino, it's no business because right. he needs somebody to talk to people right. and to relate
and
to
so, Pacino is the guy who, for his whole life, is like, make him laugh, make him laugh, make him laugh. But actually, although Hackman's, you know, been in prison, lost every job he ever had, da 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 da, essentially, Hackman's relationship with like the people that matter to Hackman is pretty good. Like his relationship with his sister's fine, his relationship with Pacino's
fine. Yeah, she's happy to see him. She's and not like you. Because it could have been like I thought it was going to be either they moved away
right.
and didn't tell him, or you bastard, what are you doing back here kind of a thing.
Right. Whereas, so let me Sorry. Finish my. So, right. and even when he finds out that the woman he's with in Denver has had things with other guys in Denver, he still like proudly stands up for her. Like he still dances with her. He doesn't like fuck you, you whore, and storm out. Like he's like, you're my woman. And she quite sweetly says to him, yeah, but not like you. Like you're the only one kind of thing. And you kind of believe her when she says that.
Yeah, that's true.
Because instead of being a ditzy thing, you at that point you kind of feel
I think that's fair.
That she said. But at the interesting thing, so what I'm saying is, while he might be fighting with the world and he might be fighting with most of the people he meets, the relationships that he has decided truly matter to him are strong, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And if anything, you know, Pacino's betrayal in the prison and at the fight and all the rest of it, like, truly hurts him.
Hang on, how does Pacino betray him in the prison?
Because he goes off with
No, but he's forced,
Richard
like, no, because Hammer doesn't want him around.
Right.
Hammer won't look.
No, I get it. Anyway.
I'm sorry, I was just wondering. I thought I might miss something. That's
no, but Hackman thinks he betrayed him in the fight as well. Anyway, so it doesn't matter. So
No, that's not why he's angry. Anyway. He's not angry about being betrayed in the fight.
All right. Forget all that then.
All right.
Hackman's relationships that matter to him remain strong.
Yeah.
Even when challenged, he still defends Pacino to the end. Right?
Yeah.
Whereas Pacino, who we know is his philosophy is make him laugh, everyone likes me because I make them laugh, right? He's the one with the big, like, personal issue. He's the one where he doesn't have any permanent friends. He doesn't have any family waiting for him. He has a woman who he left while she was 8 months pregnant.
In fact, when you think about it, and again, not giving away too much about the ending or anything, but actually, we only know of two people that Pacino is close to. And in effect, he leaves both of them at their most... like at the moment when they need him the most.
Right.
I didn't even thought of that.
Yeah. So
like the similarity between Hackman and the girlfriend.
And what's interesting is I don't think therefore the movie is saying be Hackman any more than the movie is saying be like Pacino. It's kind of saying that where Hackman reaches at the end, which is a softened version of who he is at the beginning of the film, is probably more where we should all try and end up.
Yeah, I suppose that's the thing, isn't it? Like it's a case of maybe it's a question of choice. In other words, Hackman can choose to fight, or he can choose to make him laugh, and he can decide, you know, in any given situation, what he's going to do. I guess.
The After Movie Diner with John Cross will return right after this.
Here's what some people are saying about the Projection Booth podcast.
This podcast takes no shortcut in producing outstanding content. How they haven't become more widely recognized is beyond me.
I love this show. Smart commentary, in-depth interviews, and great production.
It's obvious how serious these guys take their podcast and bring that next level of professionalism that anyone would be hard-pressed to match.
There are few things better in life than listening to people who are both passionate and knowledgeable about their subject matter. The Projection Booth, with their wide and wild range of film discussions, is one of those things. Simple as that.
The Projection Booth is the highest quality film podcast around. I love the focus on cult films, witty, informative banter, and amazing interviews. The Projection Booth is the best podcast out there, if you're a serious film lover.
The Projection Booth Podcast, with new episodes available every week at projectionboothpodcast.com.
Hello, folks. This is a promo for a podcast called The Chris and Chris Show. I'm Chris with a C.
And I'm Chris with a K. The Chris and Chris Show is a movie podcast where myself and my colleague, Chris with a C,
hello,
discuss our thoughts on films from a wide variety of genres, all in our own inimitable style.
Here's what the masses are saying about the show. Funny, irreverent film analysis.
Reviews are great and spot on. Subscribe now.
The Chris and Chris Show is a slickly produced and fun podcast with two gents who have great chemistry.
They sound like two old men.
I don't read that one.
Oh, sorry. Keeps me intrigued and keeps me entertained.
There you have it. What are you waiting for? Head on over to www.wafo...
The audio equivalent of dysentery.
Stop reading the bad ones. What are you doing? Anyway, head on over to wafofm.com. That's wafufm.com to check out the show or subscribe to The Chris and Chris Show on iTunes.
Or find us on Facebook at facebook.com/ The Chris and Chris Show. That's Chris with a C, Chris with a K.
Lovely.
The Chris and Chris Show.
The biggest load of I've ever heard.
What are you doing?
We'll do it live! F*** it! Do it live! I'll write it and we'll do it live!
Hi, I'm Jay Mayo.
And I'm Marie... I'm Marie Forster.
And we are co-hosts of Hold the Mayo podcast.
Hold the Mayo!
Hold the Mayo!
All right, give me ham on five, Hold the Mayo.
We're two local comedians. And here on Hold the Mayo, we talk about all the different things that are going on in our daily lives.
Or in your case, your pathetic dating life.
Or in your case, your obsession with pizza.
Or in your case, your Gatham for Statham.
Yeah, well, at least I'm not obsessed with Guy Fieri.
At least I'm a gang leader.
No, you're not. You're just always trying to overthrow invisible gangs.
No, I'm cool in the gang.
No, you're... Oh, my God, you're the puns are the worst.
Mayonnaise, really? That stuff is for sandwiches.
Listen, you guys can find us all across the internet. We're on iTunes, Stitcher, Spreaker, and everywhere else that podcast can be found. You can also find us all across social media. We're on Twitter at Hold the Mayo Pod, Instagram at Hold the Mayo Podcast, and of course, we have a Facebook fan page, facebook.com/HoldTheMayoPodcast.
Don't forget, you can also find Jay crying on his couch every single night.
Thank you so much.
F***ing thing sucks!
And just end it with a fart.
You're listening to the sweet sounds of the After Movie Diner. Support us at patreon.com/ After Movie Diner, or I'll punch you in the teats. Rate and review us on iTunes, Earthling.
I mean, I don't know, like the scarecrow thing. I guess the point is that a scarecrow, now I think about it, scarecrow is a matter of perception, isn't it? Like, it's just a thing. It's a signifier, as it were, that the farmer puts up, and the crows either are afraid of it or they're laughing at it.
Right.
And Hackman starts off being a scarecrow that people are afraid of and ends up being a scarecrow that they laugh at. But he can choose to be one or the other. It's about shaping, I guess, for Hackman anyway, like, it's about shaping other people's perceptions of you once upon a time. Like, there's a degree of control. It's not like he's no longer going to get into any fights. I don't believe that for a minute. And he's like, because, like, Pacino's thing, you know, the reason he's got that expression of despair is that his, like, oh, make him laugh thing is just as self-destructive a path as getting into fights.
Yeah.
It's almost like, you know, if this was like a cheesy
you know, modern movie, and this was like the first half hour, and eventually it turns out that, I don't know, Al Pacino's, you know, made of gold, but he's like Gold Man or something, whatever.
What?
I know, just like,
you
like,
lost me there.
Every movie now is like a, you know, an origin story of a superhero. So I'm just saying, if Pacino could like choose to be something, like Hackman would teach him how to fight. Do you know what I mean? Like, it would be that movie.
Right.
And Al Pacino would teach him how to laugh, and Hackman would teach him how to fight, and they'd open up a car wash, and then, I don't know, save the world, whatever. But that's not like on the cards.
No.
But it is interesting that Pacino basically retreats until he's disappeared, basically. Whereas right. Hackman.
And if anything, yeah. weirdly enough, if any part of the film for me could have been completely cut out, because we don't really learn too much, and that is the prison segment. And I tell you why, although Richard Lynch is great in it, and although there's lots of great scenes in it, and so on, I found the prison sequence to be predictable, and we don't really need, it would almost be stronger to have Hackman make that realization that he has to look after Pacino till the end, at the end of the movie, than to have that middle bit in the movie where he comes to his end.
Well, okay, so listen, my argument for the middle of the movie is this, that up until that point, it seems like Hackman is the slightly out of control, potentially violent, you know, out of prison bum, that while watchable and with a plan and very charismatic, is
he's his own worst enemy.
He's his own worst enemy, exactly. Right. And Pacino is the guy that, like, knows how to, you know, get through life, okay? He makes people laugh, he right. doesn't get into any trouble, everything's cool. So up to the prison point, that's their relationship, right? And that, those are those characters.
But also the next step is they're going to fly out to... She's going to pay for Hackman to fly out to Pittsburgh, and he's going to go up to Detroit, and they're going to meet in Pittsburgh,
right.
everything's okay.
Right, right.
And they have that big song and dance number in the bar where they're all dancing around having
right.
a great
right,
time.
Right, right, right.
And things are on the up, 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 and you see that Hackman's cold veneer is maybe starting to fade to the point where he might actually stay in Denver. He might not go to Pittsburgh.
But I agree with you. But his temper,
which is actually why he gets mad at Pacino in the prison, because he's like, "You got me to a point where I was going to
where he was going to
give it all up and change his plan."
Yeah, yeah. And that's why he's angry, because Pacino mentioned. But I'm saying, well, what happens in the prison is Hackman is proved to be the one who knows what's really going on. There's that bit when Pacino's like being driven off in the Jeep, going, "Well, so long, have a good, you know, whatever." And Hackman just looks after him, and an expression on his face, again, is like not totally readable. It seems to go, well, I know what's happening here. Do you know what I mean? Like, and Hackman's like, get away from me, and I want to talk to you, and I want to get close to him. Like, that's how I'm going to get through prison. Versus Pacino's like, oh, I'll just get on everybody's right side. It's like proved to be, the characters get totally switched. And everything after the prison is Hackman is the one who really knows what's going on. And Pacino is the one that's lost in the drift. And if you'd send Pacino to Detroit as the happy-go-lucky, I'm home from sea,
I'm the guy,
he turns up, and the wife says what she says to him over the phone, what happens to him is not going to happen. It's because in the prison, his idea of what he needs, how he needs to function on dry land, presumably having been at sea for 6 years, is totally smashed, shattered. Like, my idea of, I'll just, you know, get on people's good sides and I'll make them laugh and I'll be the scarecrow, is bullshit. And Hackman's put loads of clothes on, don't talk to anybody, keep your head down and get to where you need to get to. That's the way to go. And without that, Pacino's, what happens to Pacino at the end, and what happens to Hackman's personality at the end, make no sense. Because you're right, Hackman has to realise to take care of
Pacino. There definitely needs to be something. I guess I just felt the route it went was a little predictable at that point. I mean, there definitely needs to be that point.
I know what you're saying. I guess it's because it's about...
It's also because you've invested in that, like, buddy relationship and where it's going. And to see it...
I know, it's heartbreaking. is. It's heartbreaking.
To see them not
have Hackman together, treat him like that, you see, it feels wrong.
Right. But equally, it feels wrong to have Pacino show up on a Jeep and be like, well, you know, I could do this for you.
Well, he's
but
hurt. He's hurt.
No, I get it. I totally get
he's
it.
He's not a loyal. That's the point. Like, they're all human. Like, he's talking to him, he's trying to get him on the right, and nothing happens. And he does what any of us would done if our feelings were hurt by a friend who was ignoring us. We'd be like, oh, well, I don't care.
Yeah, no. You know? No, completely and utterly. I'm just not...
I know what you mean, but
I wasn't 100%. I love the whole fucking movie.
No, me too.
Movie.
And I do know what you mean about the prison, but I would say that the reason it has... Because I think the moment it takes place in a prison, it has, like, that predictable element to it. You know what I mean? You can kind of feel... But then that kind of slow-motion car crash isn't, like, the worst thing in the world anyway. Like, the fact you see it coming, just like Hackman sees it coming, leaning on the spade, is kind of interesting. But...
Well, Hackman sees it coming the moment Richard Lynch sits up from the bunk and is like, can I help you two?
Yeah, well, that's true. Yeah, that's a good point. But I suppose it's that... It's a feeling of, on the one hand, Pacino being totally out of his element and Hackman being in a place where he knows what's going on. But also, it's a step backwards for Hackman. But one that you get the feeling he has no intention of repeating. But he's pissed about being there. It doesn't feel like, well, I'm just going to be in and out of prison forever then, I guess. It's like, well, I'm fucking not coming back here again.
Right.
You know. So I know what you mean. I do know exactly what you're saying. I think it's one of those times when I don't really think they could have just... Like,
but I tell you... No, I agree. I do agree with that. And what's interesting about the discussion we're having is that for a movie that is seemingly just a ride-in-the-rails stroke road movie about two drifters who want to, like, be with earthy women and set up a car wash in Pittsburgh, which is the Google... It's actually, in terms of plotting, character, arcs, and all the rest of it, incredibly well structured.
Yeah, it is.
Because you're right, like, my initial feeling was like, get rid of the prison thing, it's predictable, it's obvious, and da-da-da-da-da. Just because the way it goes down, it makes you feel a lot of predictable
things.
Just going, yeah, of course, blah, 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 and of course Hackman is, you know... There isn't on the soundtrack, thankfully, but there equally could have been, like, once Hackman approaches Richard Lynch, there could have been like a da-da-da-da-da-da-da, like, here comes the hero moment, because we all want that retribution for Al Pacino and what's happened. But you're right, it is definitely one of those movies that the moment you pull out a scene,
like
a Jenga brick, the whole fucking thing comes crumbling down, because essentially... It is written in such a structured way. It looks very on the hoof and it looks very ad hoc. But if you pull out any one single scene, moment, element, or whatever, then none of it works to tell the full.
Yeah, I mean, I would love. It's definitely one of those movies that I would love to see again. But I'm very glad I saw it on the big screen.
Me too.
Because I do think that a lot of the charm of it is actually quite escapist. And it is quite, like, you know, you feel like you're on the train with them. You feel like you really feel like you're with them on the journey.
Well, I love road movies.
Yeah.
Like, even for all its faults, and there are faults both in the adaptation of the novel, but also just the way it's incredibly potentially serious. I love Into the Wild. Like, Into the Wild is one of my... comfort movies. I know that sounds really weird because it's about like a kid who essentially goes off and dies, but like I just love putting it on and being like, show me America through the eyes of these like people. I love the writing of Bukowski more so than I like the writing of Kerouac, because like Matt Farley, our friend, is really right about Kerouac. Like, he is a spoiled brat who takes his aunt's money and just fucks up with his friend and does a lot of hedonistic bullshit that doesn't really ultimately mean anything. But what's interesting about Bukowski's writing and why I kind of side with it way more is he imbues not just the everyday, but the blue-collar, poor, downtrodden American male, immigrant male. He imbues that person with poetry. And the poetry is not just like, oh, he's so drunk or whatever. Like, there's true, like, beauty and poetry to these very coarse, harsh, gritty, nondescript places that this Henry Chansky, in the case of Bukowski's writing, but it could equally be these two guys inhabit. They don't inhabit, yes, the country they're traveling through is beautiful, but they don't...
But it's quite scraggly. It's quite scraggly.
Right. And it's more those, like, when they show up to where the hobo jungle's meant to be, and it's now a big fucking power plant with an old train, burnt out train in front of it. It's those two characters that imbue that stark scene with, like, beauty, romance, and poetry.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Just that on its own. You can take a black and white photograph of it and grit it up a bit and be like, oh, look at the fucking... you know, man making his imprint on the land and blah, 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 blah. But it's the, you know, it's Waiting for Godot, isn't it? Like, to use that kind of cliche.
Yeah, to an extent it is, yeah.
Thing, which, you know, since Bottom is based on Waiting for Godot.
Yeah,
you know,
the idea of two bums just killing time.
Right.
For, you know, because they've got nothing better to do is like, yeah. They, I mean, I don't know if it happened before Waiting for Godot, but it does, it's like irredeemably tied to that because...
Yeah.
Because I suppose every bloke has at some point in his life found himself in it, and not just like, you know, for 5 minutes, but an extended period of time where it's him and another bloke basically just killing time,
right?
Because they can't think of anything better, you know, better right. to do. For and, like, you know, years.
Sometimes. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, like it's throughout literature and throughout movies and throughout lots of things, and it's. You know, and it would be really interesting, actually. It would be really interesting to sit down and have a conversation with a couple of women about all these movies and books and things that I'm talking about. Because the kind of romance of the male friendship or the male partnership or camaraderie or whatever you want to call it has been kind of dissected through the years. Whereas I feel like a lot of female relationship films, even if they have the best friend, you know, it seems very basic. Like, the best friend is the twitty friend who's always getting into trouble or sleeping with someone she shouldn't be sleeping with or whatever. And our leading female protagonist is the neurotic.
Well, I haven't seen it, but isn't Bridesmaids supposed to be a bit more kind of going down that line?
To me, in Bridesmaids, my problem with Bridesmaids was at the very beginning, the opening scenes, which were clearly very carefully written by Wig and Mumolo, who wrote the script. Yes, you're having that really well written, something that I've observed, because most of the women I've known in my life have either a good friend or good multiple friends. And I've seen the dynamics of the, I guess, the always the bridesmaid scenario and various other kind of cliches or touch points to female friendships and relationships. And the opening sequences of Bridesmaids speak very much to that. After the first act, the female best friend, the Maya Rudolph character, starts to behave completely unlike the character that's written in the first act. And everything that happens post her becoming friends with Rose Byrne, who we know, you know, that's a mistake to put Byrne in a movie to begin with, but like, her becoming friends with Rose Byrne suddenly completely starts acting out of the character that was written in the first act, and then the movie slowly degrades into just Apatow-style bottom humor and freak-out humor, where essentially you've got her drunk on a plane, isn't that funny? A bunch of women shit themselves after having dodgy Mexican food, that's funny. And her freaking out on a giant cookie or whatever at the party. Like, that's essentially like the scenes that then come next. Just Apatow going, well, okay, what set pieces of hilarity can I put in next? And all the character work is thrown out the window.
Well, no, I mean, I know that Teresa likes...
Which I may be, like, again, that's a straight male white perspective as well.
I know that Teresa likes the HBO show Girls. Like, she really likes that. For that reason, I think.
Right. And again, I think that I have a hard time with that. I've seen a few episodes and I have a hard time with that, mainly because...
mainly because, probably because I'm male, but secondly, I don't recognize a lot of the characters in the series. They don't seem realistic to me, even though they may be, and other people may have that experience and whatever. And thirdly, I find it a horrible kind of arrogant and what's the word? I realized recently that when I say hipster nowadays, what I actually mean is someone who is a poser, someone who's pretending to be something they're not, essentially, is how I use it.
But that's what we were when we were in our 20s.
No.
We were horrible posers.
I wasn't posing.
We were trying to be something that we weren't. We were reaching for something. We were dressing like for something, talking like for something, trying to act like for something. But we weren't us. I mean, you and John were a combination of Viv Stanchel, George Harrison.
All I mean is, I guess I am...
Terry Gilliam.
I guess I'm...
yeah, but that's who you
are. They are not bad
people. Terry Gilliam. No, I agree, but I'm saying...
No, but again, I think you're confusing
It's not bad. It's a bad thing. I understand what you're... Listen, I understand what you're saying, but what they're doing is no different. It seems so shallow and two-dimensional when you step back from it. It's not surrounded by nostalgia.
The reason why I started this, and I'd be really, really interested to get some emails from any of the women who listen to this show. And I totally 100% throw my hands up and say, of course, Girls is not written for me. It's not about anyone I know. Me commenting on it is irrelevant. Completely 100% aware of that. But I also consider myself to have observed female relationships and female friendships, maybe not intimately in the sense of, obviously, 3, 4, 5, 6 women, when they're on their own, are going to be different than when there's a man in the room, or men in the room. But in general, I've witnessed some pretty close female friendships, and I've not seen them written about with the same interesting complexity that men generally get written. And one of the things that I would say, that if Wes Anderson takes anything from a movie like this, or the movies of the 70s that are similar to this, Last Detail is another great example.
There was lots of Last Detail.
Is that Wes Anderson, better than anything, the thing that runs through his movies is male relationship. He writes male, even with his stylistic, esoteric way of writing, he still writes male relationship.
But it's important I agree with you, but I think it's important to say, it's important to put the caveat on there that, like, one of the reasons that we haven't seen female relationships, you know, depicted as well as male relationships in terms of, like, and I agree, a lot of it is just that, you know, up until extremely recently, you know, 99% of movies were written and directed by men.
Completely.
I think if there were two women here, I'm sure they would be able to lay out, like, a whole bunch of things, a whole bunch of examples. It's just that it's important to remember sometimes, I think, that even though we can watch a movie and enjoy the movie and relate to it, like, on a really human level, there are going to be things that we miss culturally. And the things that we miss might be the things that speak most deeply to women. Things that to us might seem irrelevant.
Completely accepting.
Right, I 100% agree. That's what I mean. Like, with something like Girls, for example, a lot of it... I'm not saying it's like Teresa's favourite show or anything, but one of the things she said to me is that it does speak to her about how she was when she was that age, when she was in her 20s.
Right.
And, like, in very truthful ways. And it's bound to be something that, in a sense, that we wouldn't even necessarily, like, know it was happening. You know, I just find it interesting. I find it interesting to consider, like, I'm sitting there watching something, and what's happening, like, seems to me to be dull and pointless and, you know, two-dimensional, and someone sitting next to me
is being moved, like, you right. know, and related to it. Like,
and also, so let's flip that on its head. Let's flip that on its head. Two women sit down to watch Scarecrow. They could be like, this is about two fucking bums. One of them is a fucking joker. Yeah, the other one's a miserable asshole. Why don't they just get off their stupid egos and go do something? Like, it could be absolutely...
No, but I'd like to see a film about these guys running a car wash. That's my kind of thing.
No, completely. Right, no. So I 100% get that. I wasn't going down a, like, chauvinistic tirade.
No, I know.
I was actually saying that I would like...
Yeah, more of it.
I would like more of it so that maybe I could be...
richer.
More empathetic, more richer, more understanding of it. In the sense that the other unfortunate thing is that so many of these films, TV shows, whatever it is, that may be written by women, produced by women, acted in by women, whatever it is, are marketed in such a, like, glossy, awful way. Like, for example, I read a review recently of that one that's just come out with Queen Latifah, Girls Trip or whatever. Now, from the poster and from the trailer and from the clips I saw on chat shows that she was on, you'd go, oh, all right, they took the Hangover, they put the, you know, four African-American women in it, and that's the movie, you know what I mean? Similarly with that one with Scarlett Johansson where they accidentally kill a male stripper, you're like, oh, they've just done very bad things, but they put a female cast, right? Because you're cynical about it, because you know how awful Hollywood is, and you see the glossy poster and you go, whatever. But I actually read a review of Girls Trip that actually said, like, it was surprisingly good and surprisingly heartwarming and surprisingly, like...
I suppose that's the check, but isn't it? Is that ultimately, you can't get away from the fact that even if it's written by women and directed by women, it's probably produced by blokes.
Right.
And then it's probably marketed by blokes.
Right.
And they probably go on a chat show that's like where what the clips they're going to get shown and how we're going to market this is decided by a bloke. It's like, and I'm not saying that it should be like, oh, well, there should be like 50% of all things should be women. I'm just saying that one of the problems, I think, with blokes that I don't think women have in the same way is blokes assume that, oh, well, My taste is, you need to filter this through what I think is good, because
right.
I'm the one who's being paid the big bucks here,
right.
As opposed to an ability to empathise with a woman or, you know, somebody else, to imagine, well, what about this film is going to appeal to its core audience? What is thinking about, what about Girls Night Out? You know, subconsciously, you know, do I think it's funny? Because that's what we should go with. I mean, it's like, but like, you're not. You know, 40-something marketing guy, no way are you going to the cinema to watch, you know, Girls Night Out, the Queen of the Teeth in a million years. So why the hell are you deciding what clips should be all,
no,
you know
completely.
What I mean?
It's just
one of those things that actually, it's not about, oh, bruh, men run the world. It's just that men aren't good at empathising and putting themselves in the position of other people. What they rely on is, you know, gut instinct and, you know, it's, what I think is funny, well, that's what's funny, and like, and that's you know, that's a good way to be. It's where it's got them where they've got to. It's just because men aren't very good at that. It means that women's films and lots of other movies, you know, it drives us crazy sometimes about like science fiction films or whatever, like the way they sell things or like what they did to Star Trek. It's like, yeah, but you don't get Star Trek, do you?
Right.
You know, and it's not that there aren't people involved like Peg and Cyber God who don't get Star Trek. It's just that nowadays. You know, one of the great things about Scarecrow is the people that actually made Scarecrow, you know, put it together and made it, you know, could be fitted, you know, around the, you know, a table for eight people, you know what I mean? Who actually made that film.
Right, and even
and
we
no
found out from the director
like that,
that Al Pacino stamped his little feet and went, re-edit it and put me more in it.
Yeah.
And not only did Warner, but this was post-Godfather, not only did Warner Brothers go, no, we like it as it is, but like it went on to win the Palm d'Or.
Yeah, so my point is that back then, you could make a film where it was, you know, 8 or 10 people making it. And so when you get like a small number of people like that together, they can make something that does almost have like a unique voice because they're all following one vision that they all see
and I guess,
parts of it
and
they don't make films like you're saying with Bridesmaids, right? If it was just you know, wig and, you know, 7 or 8 other people, and you could take all the people that made Bridesmaids and threat them around one table, it would have been a much better film. But you can bet that there were test audiences and producers and marketers and, you know, this bloke and that bloke and the other, and like rewritten, you know, by 6 different people, and ultimately you need a small restaurant, you know, to house them all.
Well, also because,
and that's not a vision anymore, that's just like a polished product.
Also because they have things like, you know, while this has to be a big summer comedy,
yeah,
it's about women and weddings. People love women and weddings. It's a big summer comedy. And I'm like, I watched that first sequence where they sat down in the cafe, and I'm like, I bet the first or second draft of this movie is a cracker. And I reckon that whatever was done to make it a big summer movie, ruined it.
Yeah. Well, all we can hope, listen, we should probably leave it here, but all we can hope is that, you know, Matt Farley's vision of small B-movie, fun, you know, honest films. I mean, not I'm saying that, like, you know, River Beast or Slingshot Cops are honest, but they're honest in the sense that they're honestly what the people making it think is funny and the best that they could do, rather
than honest films. That's what I was attracted to the first time.
That the reason those films are good is that, again, you could gather the people that made it around one table, and it's honestly what they think is the best movie. But I bet Wig and Feig and all the rest of them involved with Bridesmaids, like, there were moments when they made decisions that honestly they didn't think were the best decisions. You know what I mean? And that's what kind of, you know, the more films like Farley, that's the future. Smaller films, more of them.
And I will say this, you know, we went off on a different, interesting discussion, hopefully interesting for people listening, but, like, I would welcome, and I don't mean movies with axes to grind or movies with messages or movies with, like, empowerment or anything like that necessarily. Although, look, all of those movies are
worth
your
life. Grind your empowerment axes.
But what I'm saying is, I would go for a female-driven movie era that rivals the 70s, that tells the stories that they're telling in the 70s predominantly by men, for men, with men. And I would be interested to see what 7 or 8 years of that looked like. If some studio would be brave enough to pony up the cash and say, look, we're going to make a bunch of $10 million movies. You can tell the stories you want to tell, written by the women, starring the women, directed by the women. And I want to see some of that.
But see, that's what I like. The bits of Wonder Woman I really liked. But the bits
I haven't seen it yet. I do want to see it. It's pretty good.
And the best bits in it are the bits where, like, when she goes into, like, war zones or whatever, her reaction is not like, grrr, or whatever.
I've got to fight.
It's like, it's kind of, yeah, it's like this horror and disbelief that people would do this to each other. It's just, in a, like, a big budget, there's just moments in it where there's just, like, the female perspective is almost like a Crocodile Dundee fish out of water comedy about like dropping a woman into a superhero film. It's not like, oh, well, you know, she wears tights and she's got, you know, big boobs, so, and that's it, the end of her character kind of thing, and, oh yeah, she's a bit nurturing. It's like, what would actually happen if you put a woman into the middle of an action film, and how would she respond to that, and what decisions would she make? And that, when that's being honest, when that's honestly what's happening, that kind of fish out of water in an action movie thing, that's when it's at its best, you know. It's really, really good. And he's great, Pine is good, but she's brilliant. It's those bits which are, like, honestly, it's mostly just a standard, like, blurg, you know, action superhero movie. But there's enough bits in it, like in the first Captain America or the Avengers or Iron Man 3, there's enough bits in it that are, like, that's honest and fun and relatable and true, and there's just moments in it.
Don't get me wrong. You know, a lot of the chants these days, or a lot of the online petitions these days, are about, like, just more female directors in general, more female writers in general, you know, and big budget movies being handed over to female directors, which I'm all for as well. But I'm talking more of, you know, the Coppolas and the Scorseses and the of the world, and seeing a female equivalent of those telling their stories. And I don't, you know,
well, they are out there. Who's the one that did the American Honey?
American Honey?
It's that movie. She did a movie called Fish Tank. That won.
See, I need you to tell me something. These things because I'd watch.
Well,
are they good?
Well, I think they're exactly what you're talking about. They're gritty, 70s, female driven stories. They're British. She's a British director.
Okay.
American Honey's about a teenage girl on a road trip across America. I think it's got like Shia LaBeouf in it, believe it or not. But it, I don't know if it won at Cannes, but it did well. But it's that and another one called Fish Tank, and they're exactly what you're talking about. They're 70s ethos of, you know, gritty,
character-driven
stuff, but it's female. She's a female director. The leads are female.
There was a good one. I don't know who wrote and directed it, but Kristen Wiig, after doing Bridesmaids, went off and did a whole bunch of, like, indie, lower budgeted comedies, drama comedies, and most of them, to be honest, were pretty bad.
Skeleton Toes is not good.
Skeleton Toes is alright, but it wasn't like amazing. But there was one she did that I think didn't like, that was her, Annette Bening, and someone else, and it's like Wig fails at whatever she was trying to be, and she has to go back and live on the Jersey Shore with her mother. Matt Dillon's in it as well. It's like Annette Bening's like much younger guy. And it was like charming, interesting, funny, dramatic, character-driven. Like, it had a whole bunch of stuff in it. And it was far from perfect. But it was, of all those, like, Skeleton Twins, Welcome to Me, and some of the other ones she did, like, this one was one that I would definitely watch again. And I remember feeling really charmed by it. Much in the same way that, like, Dan in Real Life, the Steve Carell movie, which everyone, like, kind of pans or disregards or doesn't remember, is actually, like, a really well-written, sweet, charming movie.
Yeah, is that
movie.
The one where he's, like, the problem, the agony uncle, and he has
to go away for, like, Thanksgiving to his family.
Yeah, I like that one.
Yeah, and
I
he like falls for Juliette Binoche in a bookshop, only to find out that she's dating his brother.
I like that. Although, I mean, to me, Steve Carell in, like, indie movies, like, semi-serious indie movies, it doesn't get any better than him in Little Miss Sunshine for me. He's so...
Right.
He's actually the reason I watched that film again. He's so good.
Right.
In Little Miss Sunshine.
But no, so anyway. Scarecrow, it's wonderful. Dig it out. I don't know if it's on DVD or Blu-ray. I haven't looked it up.
I haven't got a clue.
It is one that the Criterion Collection should put out in a, like...
Yeah, it's really, really good. Disc. Yeah. I enjoyed the hell out of it. And even I'd never heard of it before. And I'm stunned that I hadn't heard of Al Pacino and Gene Hackman in a 70s, playing 70s drifters riding trains.
Yeah.
Oh. In a kind of an offbeat, like, comedy.
And if you like this, also check out Ironweed, which is Jack Nicholson, Meryl Streep, and Tom Waits in a Bukowski story of people down on the luck.
Cool. Thanks for the tip, man.
Which is another one, like Nicholson playing a hobo, under the radar movie. Barfly with Mickey Rourke and Faye Dunaway is okay. It's not great. I didn't mind. Matt Dillon did a Bukowski book, Factotum.
Yeah.
It wasn't bad. It wasn't great, but it wasn't bad. It was certainly better than Barfly. But there's a whole bunch of these movies out there. Road movies, existential movies, and buddy movies. With Elle and I is a great English kind of...
Midnight Run.
Companionship.
There were parts of it that was more of a Midnight Run. You know, they're riding the train and De Niro and Grodin.
Yeah. Yeah, I need to own this. So it was great. Thanks so much, Jim.
Well, thanks for having me, man.
I'm just a scarecrow without you. Baby, please don't disappear. I beg your pardon, dear. I got a bottle for a trumpet and a hat box for a drum. And I beg your pardon, dear. Got upset, I lost my head. I didn't mean the things I said. You are the land.
pardon.